I'm Laura Murphy Oates, and this is The Full Story.
So Dahab is this small beach town in Sinai on the Red Sea, and it's one of both me and Jess's favorite places in Egypt. You know, lazy beach town with a lot of palm trees. I was just about to have lunch or a late breakfast at this Indian restaurant on the beach there, somewhere that I've been going to for like 20 years. And just before I had a chance to eat my lunch, someone came and asked for me. I saw who was asking for me, and I immediately figured out that, yeah, that's the state security thing coming. I'm being arrested. And I just complied, and I was taken. Chatted a bit with the officer, trying to figure out what's happening. So I was taken from there in a car and taken away.
That was the moment that Karim Inara knew he was about to be taken to an Egyptian jail. His crime? Working for an NGO in a country where security forces have been cracking down on the work of human rights groups, as well as regularly arresting journalists. Karim was taken to Cairo, where he was held in solitary confinement, accused of joining a terrorist group and spreading fake news. He and a number of colleagues have joined the thousands, potentially tens of thousands, of political prisoners believed to be held in Egyptian prisons. His sudden disappearance terrified his British wife, Jess Kelly.
I just kind of felt like it's happened, you know, this thing that was always in the air or always something that we were slightly threatened with. I was like, it's happened. I felt like a bit of a death sentence. And also just the fact that I'd lost Karim as my person to speak to. I had to be making decisions myself and I couldn't go to him anymore.
Today, the human rights workers facing arrest 10 years on from Egypt's Arab Spring Revolution. It's Tuesday, the 22nd of June. Anushka Astana is the presenter of Today in Focus, our global news podcast, where this episode first aired.
Karim, you're in Cairo, and Jess, you're based in London. I want to start this by going back to 2009, the year you guys actually met. What were you up to then, Karim? And what were things like in Egypt?
In 2009, I was working in legal aid for refugees and asylum seekers in Cairo. There was a lot of youth movements mobilizing, and I was part of that. I counted as youth back then. Life under Mubarak, it was an authoritarian police state, but it was much less heavy-handed than the current administration.
Right.
And there was a little bit of a margin for freedom of expression, relatively speaking, specifically in the 2000s. You know, there was a semi-independent press, and then you had the internet and the sudden social media revolution. Like, my generation was suddenly exposed to a lot more than our previous generation. And that kind of created a desire for more political representation and expansion of that really small margin of freedom of expression and for more civil liberties and more participation in politics.
And Jess, that's when you first noticed Karim.
So I was studying Arabic at university and I was in Cairo for my year abroad. And I'd met Karim through a group of friends. And yeah, he did make an impression quite immediately on me.
What do you mean? What kind of impression?
He was very full of energy, often kind of making disparaging remarks, and he was someone you kind of were drawn towards.
What about you, Karim?
I just know I was really attracted. I mean, she was smart and funny, and we were both interested in the same kind of thing, and she had that edge that I don't have.
So that was 2009, and by the start of 2011, Egypt was now becoming swept up in the Arab Spring. Protests were beginning to really build. They were overwhelming.
Tens of thousands of Egyptians have taken to the streets in unprecedented protests that have left at least three people dead. Inspired by Tunisia's Jasmine Revolution, crowds gathered across the country to chant anti-government slogans. Down with Hosni Mubarak, they shouted, referring to the 82-year-old president who has ruled for three decades. Such dissent is rarely tolerated, but the protesters say they want an end to authoritarian rule.
And then in February, a huge moment. President Hosni Mubarak resigned, showing just how much impact these protests sweeping across the Middle East and North Africa were having.
Hosni Mubarak's 30 in Alexandria, in Ismailia, in Suez. Unbelievable scenes.
Karim, from that period, what are the feelings and memories that stick with you?
Oh, 2011, it was unprecedented. It was the kind of thing that happens like not just once in a generation, once in a lifetime, but it was a really historical moment. There was just a huge opening up of space for political and social engagement that just didn't exist before. Politics, even opposition politics and resistance politics, was a very elite thing. And suddenly, which just became so mainstream, so many people were involved in everything, not necessarily on your side all the time. Actually, the vast majority of people tended to be not on your side most of the time. But still, it was good and exciting to be engaging with student movements, with unions, even with state institutions that you never had the chance to engage with before, like the parliament. So it was a very happening time, and everything was changing so quickly.
So Jess, the next thing to happen was that elections took place and the government of Mohamed Morsi of the Muslim Brotherhood came to power. What were you doing over the next few years?
I had finished university and I moved back to Egypt to try to do journalism and make documentaries. And it's crazy now to think that I was able to do that, you know, to hold a camera in Egypt, which is something that I would never do now. And I also was there in 2013.
Fireworks and jubilation erupted in Tahrir Square tonight as the military announced it dissolved Egypt's constitution and deposed President Mohamed Morsi after just 1 year in office. In a speech to the nation, the head of the military said they were responding to the calls of the people. The military also blamed Morsi for failing to unite Egyptians.
And what was it like in that period?
Being in Tahrir during the demonstrations of 2013 was maybe one of the scariest things I filmed. It was at the time when sexual harassment was really peaking, and I was filming some of that, and it was very terrifying.
Can you tell us what happened?
Yeah, at some points I would be filming from the top of a building with a very large zoom lens and basically zooming in on women being picked out from the crowd and sexually harassed, raped. And I was trying to document the efforts of a Egyptian group who were trying to help women. Often they would throw a flare and that was how I could see what was happening. And then the most scary was when I would need to move through that crowd myself to kind of get in or out. And I would always have like a male friend or colleague helping me through. It was a very scary time and very different from how protests had been at the beginning of the 2011 demonstrations.
Karim, while Jess was by then working all over the Middle East, you would go on to work for a major human rights group in Egypt called EIPR, the Egyptian Initiative for Personal Rights. It's worked since 2002 to fight for criminal justice, for social, economic and environmental rights, as well as for the rights of people with disabilities and LGBTQ communities. It's also fought against the death penalty. You would later become the director of its criminal justice division. Looking back, what had you hoped might come from the revolution? And what were you actually seeing?
I mean, I was quite young and idealistic. So right now it feels like if I'd come back then, I would temper my hopes significantly. But we had very ambitious plans for reforming the security sector and reforming a criminal justice system. All of these hopes were dashed and everything is a lot worse than it used to be, especially in the criminal justice department.
Tell me why. You were obviously working in an NGO focusing on criminal justice, focusing on political prisoners. How had things been before and how were they changing?
Some of it is like very immediate impact. With criminal defense, you have people with like legal cases. Sometimes you win. Sometimes you get someone out of a very difficult situation. Sometimes you bring a lawsuit against the government and very rarely you win, but occasionally you do. And Egypt always had an authoritarian legal system, but it was a functional legal system that is more than 100 years old. And like the Egyptian judiciary always took pride in how old it is. So there was always room for maneuver within that legal system. But most of the impact you thought you're having was much more medium-term or long-term, right? Ideas about how governance should work. But then that was kind of receding, anything related to politics or state security, anything related to the work of the government. It was just becoming a lot more difficult to challenge that in court. And people were a lot less confident and a lot more scared about approaching you, asking for help and talking about the kind of legal aid we did. So you felt like the impact you were having was much more difficult to measure. But then you always ask yourself that question of like, if I pull out, if all of this ends, one day, there's always going to be someone who's going to lose, someone who needs defense or representation before that very scary state apparatus. And that kept you going.
Did you feel that it was getting more intense? Were you getting scared?
Yeah, of course, all the time. You know, there was always a certain balance that you thought existed. You always thought that there were some clear red lines and you could calculate the risk and you can always do a cost-benefit analysis and justify to yourself what you're doing. But that cost-benefit analysis was increasingly becoming a tricky one and they were becoming a lot more fuzzy, these red lines.
And Jess, how did you feel about Kareem's work at that time?
I was aware that a lot of the work was becoming quite thankless and really impossible to see kind of positive impact. And I guess I was progressively getting a bit more worried about him.
Why? What were you worried about? What were you seeing happening?
Well, there were big crackdowns on NGOs. Lots of them were closed. Lots of people were arrested. Hossam, who's the founder of Kareem's organization, was arrested. He was put under a travel ban. It's a very obvious downturn in the safety of people like Kareem. And Kareem would always convince me that he wasn't high profile enough and that therefore he'd be more safe than other people who were being arrested or silenced.
And it's in that context that the first really scary thing happened, that your colleague Patrick Zaki was detained. Tell me about him.
So my colleague Patrick, he was one of my younger colleagues, he was a gender researcher. And Patrick, he's one of those people who's just really full of energy. And that is something that was reflected in his work, but also in his political activism. He was a lot more outspoken than most of us at that point, right? And he was on educational leave, pursuing a master's degree in Italy. And he was returning home in February 2020 to visit his family when he was just stopped and arrested at the airport. And we didn't think that this is going to last very long, but he's been in prison in pretrial detention for almost a year and 2 months. And previously, like Jess had mentioned, there are people who were arrested from EIPR for a couple of days and we'd be able to get them out. So when Patrick was arrested, we launched this campaign and did everything we could in terms of political pressure and advocacy. And we just didn't think that he's going to be in prison for that long. The vast majority of cases are being processed by that system. They're a legal front for keeping people in detention for months or sometimes years without really investigating anything and without really trying them. And that's what happened with Patrick. So he's faced charges of like abusing social media to disseminate false information, undermining national security and membership of a terrorist organization. They never faced Patrick with any evidence except a few social media posts that he denied were his. And if you look at them, they don't involve incitement to anything really. They're just political content. His detention is being renewed, pending investigation, but no investigation happened and no trial really happens.
What group are they describing as a terrorist group?
They don't even tell you what group it is. They don't need to tell you that. The SSSP system, it's a complete abuse of the legal process. And he's been in pre-trial detention for close to 14 months now.
When you knew that Patrick had been arrested, Jess, how were you feeling?
When Kareem told me Patrick had been arrested, I think I'd just met Patrick a few months before when I'd been in Egypt visiting Kareem. They were playing football together and it was just very surreal to think that this really sweet young guy was now locked up. That was it. And I remember thinking, now this is getting slightly closer to home. Kareem was becoming a lot more paranoid and the sense that he should leave was starting to grow.
Okay, so Patrick was arrested in February 2020. Then the pandemic hit, and I understand you guys got married while things were still quite restricted with a small do in Cairo in September. And that was quite a turning point for you as a couple. Jess, you went back to London, and Kareem, you decided that you would move there too for a fresh start. But you didn't do that immediately. You carried on working. And in that time, there was a public meeting with 13 foreign ambassadors and diplomats talking about your work that seems to have caught the attention of the Egyptian authorities. Tell me what happened in November.
I was watching TV with a friend and I got a missed call from him and I called him back and he was really taking this seriously and he said that police had gone to his mum's home in Cairo and tried to arrest him and kind of began to give me, well, at first he was just kind of sort of crying a bit and saying, I'm so sorry I didn't leave sooner. I was just trying to tell him, like, don't be sorry, it's not your fault, and I don't blame you. And just trying to kind of make sure he didn't have that feeling of guilt. And then he just kind of gave me some advice of what he wanted me to do if he was arrested. We kind of hung up the call and I had my friend with me and I just kind of went into her and burst into tears.
It's definitely the most difficult phone call I've ever had to make. And it was difficult to be calm when I was speaking with Jess. I mean, I had to try to prepare her for what was going to happen. And there was a lot of contradictory and confusing emotions. You know, I had to try to be strong and composed, but, you know, I that feeling of guilt towards Jess and towards my mother and my family just washed over me.
Guilty? Why? What had you done? What were you guilty about?
For the last 1 or 2 years, I was really tired of working in human rights and legal aid, and I was ready to try something new. And Jess, she's always been much more of a doer than I am. So she was the one who's pushing for us to, like, just sort it out instead of that limbo we were in and live together somewhere, whether it's Egypt or London. And then we finally agreed in London. But I took a lot of time over decisions. It was difficult for me to leave Egypt, to leave my job, even though I really wanted to. But I was maybe propelled by this inertia and this feeling of guilt and responsibility towards the place and towards my colleagues. And I was really attached to Egypt and Cairo. And Jess, I could tell last time I saw how excited she was when we got married that we're finally going to be doing this. And that's why I felt guilty, because once we managed to get the ball moving, this happened. And I knew that this wasn't going to be easy.
Kareem, it must have been really scary. As you said earlier, you weren't in Cairo. You were at an Egyptian beach resort in Dahab. You described sitting at a restaurant by the sea, waiting, knowing something was about to happen. And then they came for you. Tell me where they took you.
I knew I was going to be taken for state security interrogation. State security is the branch of the police that is all powerful and that deals with politics and anything that has to do with state security.
What was that like?
I was asked a lot of questions about my work and my politics. I was there for maybe 7-8 hours by my estimation. I didn't have a watch and I was blindfolded, and you don't know where you are or who you're speaking to. I was just asked a lot of questions and then transported in a vehicle to Cairo while still blindfolded for maybe 9-10 hours.
Gosh.
It had been a long day, but I'd been running on adrenaline, obviously. So I was really hoping that I wouldn't go to state security prosecution. I was hoping maybe another officer would see me and talk to me, and this will end before the formal process starts. Because once the formal process starts, you're in the black hole and only a few people can really decide when you're coming out of it. So when I arrived in Cairo and I realized that I'm in state security prosecution, that's when I suddenly just like broke down. I mean, I was really deeply sad and depressed, because I was like, now I know what's going to happen.
Could you speak to anyone? Could you speak to your family? Could you speak to Jess?
No, I couldn't. That parallel system that exists for state security cases is a system where your rights are very deeply curtailed. But because we have a lot of experience in this, and because my colleagues knew I was arrested, they sent lawyers, my colleagues, and they essentially go and try to find you, because otherwise you're not allowed a phone call, you're not allowed to speak to family. But if your lawyer isn't there, if you're lucky, and you know, sometimes our lawyers go and they just offer legal representation to people who don't have lawyers. That's how it usually works. There's a system where there's a complete blackout. And so I ran in the corridor while I was being escorted to the prosecutor into my colleagues. And that's the first person I spoke to, and the only people I spoke to for a while.
What were you charged with?
I was charged with membership of a terrorist organization, disseminating false information, abusing social media accounts to disseminate false information in an attempt to undermine national security. And then I think it was well into the evening of the 18th when I was just transported to my place of detention, which is a prison in southern Cairo.
Jess, how did you find out?
I called Kareem's friend and she just said, yeah, it's not good. They've taken Kareem. She said that they were on their way to the police station to try to find out what was happening. And I was on my bike in London and, yeah, I tried to cycle and then I couldn't really. And then just kind of collapsed and was just like crying in the street. And poor man passed by and was like, are you okay? And I said, my husband's been arrested in Egypt, and kind of asked if he could do anything to help. And I was like, no, I'm fine. And I just picked myself back up and got home, and then started basically receiving calls from friends and Kareem's boss, Gerset, as well.
I arrived in prison late at night and I was in what you can describe as solitary confinement. I mean, I was fine. I was exercising, eating my meals, but I was alone. And that's the most defining thing about that
period of imprisonment. It's extremely lonely in there. So you have a lot of time to basically just lie down and stare at the ceiling and think about all the possible scenarios that this can play out. And sometimes I feel optimistic and sometimes I feel really scared. And there are times when you feel like you really, really acutely miss Jess or your family. And there are times when you speak to people hanging outside and it feels a bit better. But there are long periods of silence and loneliness. And some days I go to sleep and I have dreams about resuming my normal life. And waking up from that is a bit difficult.
Jess, during this period, you couldn't talk to Kareem, but you were doing everything you could to try to secure his release. What was that like?
It was complete, just like crazy kind of organized chaos, I guess. A few of my best friends came and stayed with me and they would kind of help me sort out who I was going to speak to and feed me, because there's no way I could have fitted in like doing anything normal, like eating or cooking. I just kind of would go from one to the next and it almost feels like a dream now.
Mr. Inara's UK-based wife, Jess Kelly, had been hoping to join him in Egypt after they got married.
I remember during this period kind of barely sleeping and often getting quite emotional during the interviews.
I was expecting that he would be coming to the UK by February and that we would be starting our lives together in the UK.
It's really, really draining. And that's kind of the better part of the day, when you're at least active and you're doing something that you think has got a purpose. But often at night, I would just feel very empty and scared. But yeah, I remember after about 10 days of this, I kind of reached a point where I knew I had like two more interviews that afternoon and I just felt like I can't do it. That was the night that I did the Christian Amanpour interview.
Jess Kelly, welcome to the programme. And let me just ask you on a personal note, how are you holding up and have you been able to in any way communicate with your jailed husband?
Which I'm so glad I did, because I think it made a big difference. And then I think I took maybe 1.5 day off or something like that. And it wasn't long after that that Kareem was actually released.
Kareem, there had been a massive international campaign that had seen US congressmen sending letters, British and American politicians making calls, and celebrities sending their support.
I want to highlight the plight of four people wrongfully arrested for their work, fighting for the dignity of others.
Kareem is 37 today, and instead of celebrating at home, he's locked up in prison.
I was very sad and distressed to hear that Kareem Inara had been put into prison in Egypt.
After all of that, it was over actually quicker than anyone expected. The period of pre-trial detention for you and two colleagues lasted 14 days. Tell me about getting out.
We were really surprised to be released. I mean, the release process was very quick as well. It's usually a very long and complicated bureaucratic process, and we just let out of the prison, the three of us. And we were hoping that Patrick would come out with us, but he wasn't. Obviously, this was a different case, and it was just released, and we went to Gessler's house because he lives quite close to the prison. And then everyone came. It just happened, you know, we weren't really planning a celebration or a party. It's just like everyone knew where we were. And like all of our friends and family just came to that place. That moment was amazing. Almost everyone I knew was there except Jess. And I really wanted to be with Jess. And then I got there and I obviously immediately just got on the phone with Jess. And we just both burst into tears. We can really speak for a couple of seconds. Can, you know, get out words. I was really on top of the world because I really didn't think that this was going to happen so soon.
How soon did you realise that this was actually far from over?
So we were released on Thursday, and then Friday, when things settled down a little bit, I was told by my colleagues that there's a court session on Sunday for the three of us, for the court to decide on. The prosecutor asked to freeze our assets, which is a punitive measure that they use against people. I mean, it's not like we have a lot of assets, but usually these measures come hand in hand, asset freezes and travel bans. We were really hoping still that the court would decide in our favour. But that didn't happen. And so I wasn't able to travel to see Jess.
Next, 6 months on, Kareem remains in Cairo, unable to move to London as planned. And Patrick remains in prison.
For some time after this, Jess, you weren't able to actually visit. You were nervous about what that might mean for Karim, who was still under a travel ban and with this asset freeze. But eventually you did go last month. What was it like when you saw Karim?
You know, in a way, it felt very normal, almost like nothing had happened. But at the same time, it was kind of reconnecting after such a huge thing has happened in our lives. Yeah, it's hard to describe. Maybe Karim will do it better.
Karim?
Can't really describe it in words. I felt at home, maybe in a certain sense, for the first time since I've come out, because Jess was with me.
Can I have one of the cardamom?
What did you do together?
Normally when me and Karim get together, we think about what are the best things we can eat and the best coffee we can drink. So we went to some of the good cafes in Maadi and just doing those kind of everyday things that are actually just such a luxury for Karim and me because we don't get to do them. Things like watching Netflix. That was nice to properly connect with people like Karim's mum, for example, who, you know, I had kind of just met her when we got married and then obviously we spoke a lot while Karim was in prison, and then now to kind of see her and have that relief was, yeah, felt like we kind of covered a lot of distance very quickly.
So your assets have been frozen. What does that include?
It just means that I can't access my bank accounts. I don't have access to the banking system.
How do you live? Where do you get money from?
I mean, I still have my jobs and I'm still able to get some cash payments. So for the time being, it's fine. I have some money that I can live off. But it's precarious. I don't know what's it going to be like in the future because I'm not sure what I'm going to do and I'm not sure how the bank freezes, how long that's going to last.
And Karim, all of this so far has been about pre-trial detention. The charges are still there against you. For Patrick, he's been constantly in jail under pre-trial detention. You are out, but under these restrictions. What can happen now?
So there's a couple of different scenarios. Now, first, what we're trying to do legally and politically and using every tool that is available to us is to get these charges dropped. Because remember, again, we were prosecuted for doing essentially NGO work and charged with membership of terrorist organization. Now there was a lot of pressure and we were released. And our NGO, EIPR, we started the process of registration under the new NGO law, which was issued last year, which is quite restrictive. But, you know, we think we're going to be able to work on the ground in Egypt. Now, we're hoping that once that registration process is underway, that they will drop the charges against us. So that's the first scenario. If the charges are dropped and we don't have an open investigation. In that case, there's no threat and our assets are unfrozen. And hopefully I'll be able to travel. Now, the second possibility is that the charges are not dropped, but these measures are lifted. So it's kind of like some sort of halfway solution. You know, you live with these charges like a lot of people hanging over their heads for a very long time, but you're not being pursued, you're not in detention, and you can access your bank accounts and you're able to travel. Now, the third scenario, since you're asking what could happen, in theory, obviously, they can decide to press with the charges and refer you to trial. Now, we don't think that this is likely to happen. The most common scenario in these kind of political, because essentially these are political cases, the most common scenario is that these measures, whether they are pretrial detention or asset freezes or travel bans, they are used in themselves as some kind of warning or punishment for people who practice politics. And in our case, we're detained for 2 weeks. Patrick has been in detention for 16 months. There are people who haven't been detained, like my boss, Hussam. He's had an asset freeze and travel ban for years. So we don't expect that there will be an actual referral to trial. Now, if there is a referral to trial, if you're charged in a counterterrorism case, you're facing charges that can land you in prison for a very, very long period of time.
And Jess, how is this all for you?
Well, it's really tough. You know, we're in a limbo and we can't make any plans for the future or even have a normal relationship right now because we're totally controlled by whether or not these restrictions will be lifted. Because Karim can't travel, I now have to make sure that I can go to Egypt for months at a time, which is obviously not really very realistic with work and COVID especially. Karim is also kind of in a limbo in terms of what he can do now with his life. And it's scary when you look around at other colleagues and friends who, as Karim said, Hossam has had a travel ban for years.
you know, I don't let myself think about that reality, but it's pretty scary. And I just hope that we're going to be lucky and that these restrictions will be lifted soon. But it's tough.
And I appreciate, given what you told me earlier about working as a journalist in Cairo, that it might not be possible to live there together. But have you considered that?
You know, me and Jess, we both lived in Egypt and in UK, and we both have our affinity with both places. Jess spent more time in Egypt than I had spent in the UK. When we were having this conversation, obviously Egypt was an option just as much as London was an option, but it just wasn't a very practical option for many reasons. One of which is that for Jess's kind of work, Egypt is not a very easy place for documentary filmmaking. So she would have to be like going back and forth a lot, whereas I can actually work from London.
One of the ironies here is that for many years, Karim, you've dedicated your work to trying to help political prisoners. And there are believed to be thousands or even tens of thousands of them in Egypt. Many charity workers or journalists or even individuals voicing an opinion on social media who have found themselves targeted by legislation that is supposed to be there for terrorists. And now you've been caught up in that same cycle. In your case, terrible though it is, I guess luckily you did not spend as long in prison. We know that Patrick is still in detention and questions are being asked about what is happening to him in there. If you could speak directly to the people making these decisions, what would you both say? Jess?
I would just say that Karim doesn't deserve to be punished for anything. He's never done anything wrong. And we deserve to live our lives together and not be controlled by this baseless accusation. And I mean, it's very hard to send a message to people who have done this to Karim.
What about you, Karim?
This is a very insidious way of destroying people's lives, and I'm hoping that this won't last very long and that we can put this behind us, so I can reunite with Jess and we can resume our plan to live together.
Karim, Jess, thank you very much.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you, Anushka. Thank you for having us.
That was Karim Inara and Jess Kelly. My thanks to both of them. Today marks 500 days in which Patrick Zaki has been in prison. I want to thank our colleague Ruth Michelson for her help on this piece. In terms of a response from the Egyptian government, in December, President Sisi said in an interview that the problem with Karim and EIPR's particular case was that they registered themselves as a commercial company in violation of Law 2019 for activities of associations that do not seek profit. President Sisi has said, Egypt is working on striking a balance between protecting rights and confronting security challenges and fighting terrorism. That is it for today. This episode was produced by Courtney Youssef. Sound design was by Axel Cacoutier. The executive producers are Phil Maynard and Archie Bland. We'll be back tomorrow.